Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast, brought to you by Athletes on the Rise, the training company dedicated to developing complete athletes that obtain college scholarships and professional contracts. Athletes on the Rise uses multidisciplinary sports science knowledge to develop athletes mentally, physically, technically, and tactically. We go above and beyond what is expected to give you a training experience that is tailored to you in a way no one else can offer. Train with us and become the best version of yourself. Athletes on the Rise, training redefined. Follow us online at our website, http://aotr.training. On Instagram, @aotr.training. On Twitter, @aotr_training. And then facebook.com/aotr.training. Coach Eric here from Athletes on the Rise on the Rise Up Podcast, here with coach and scout Dave Bullwinkle. How you doing, Dave?
Doing fine. It's kind of a strange period of time for all of us, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it really is. But thankfully, it leads to kind of situations like this where we can kind of talk about basketball a little bit and educate the public and, you know, try to make lemonades out of lemons, so to speak. Do the best we can.
Sounds good to me. Let's go.
All right, let's get it. So quick overview on Dave. Dave has a phenomenal coaching experience from coaching from the 70s all the way up into the early 2000s and currently does work as a scout with the Chicago Bulls. So we're just going to go through his coaching career, you know, his experiences, why he did things in certain ways, and then we'll segue into his current area where he is doing both scouting with the Bulls. And then are you still doing the work with Comcast? Are you still announcing?
Yeah, I do the Mountain West commentating. As a color commentator for the Mountain West Conference.
Gotcha. So we'll speak a little bit to that as well. So going back a little bit here. So you started off at the high school level out there on the West Coast. After you got out of college, or was it out of high school? I mean, how did you get your start, and why did you start at the high school level back then?
Well, when I was a high school athlete, I was pretty good in football and basketball, good enough to get recruited at the Division I level in both. But I'm 5'10", so I thought I had a better shot as a defensive back instead of as a basketball player, even though I liked basketball better. And I originally went to Princeton University, where I played football, and I transferred to Cal Berkeley. I didn't like Princeton. It was a great school. It just didn't fit me. And I transferred to the University of California, Berkeley, where I played football, albeit very badly. And I was headed to law school, and I just decided it was 1972, and I really didn't feel like going to three more years of law school, to then prepare for the bar, et cetera. So I decided in the state of California, you have to go to a fifth year of education to get your teacher credential. And I would do that. And I would teach U.S. history and government in high school, which I did. And I would coach football and basketball, which I did for 4 years. And after the fourth year, I was the JV coach at a high school in basketball. And I went to the head basketball coach at the University of California, who had recruited me when he'd been the head coach at the University of the Pacific, made a good decision not to offer me a scholarship. But I had stayed in touch with him for a lot of reasons, because I was still involved with basketball and I was a student at Cal at one time. And anyway, I wanted to see if he'd be willing to be to recommend me for head jobs in high school. He said, of course, not a problem at all. He said, have you ever thought about coaching in college? I said, well, you know, not really. I said, I went to the Final Four the year before that, which is true. I'd driven to San Diego, crashed on a buddy's place. That was Wooden's last national
championship. I was going to say, that's the Wooden area.
That
was an amazing time.
And I'll tell you, and the teams in the Final Four that year, Eric, were UCLA, who won it. They beat Kentucky in the championship game after beating Louisville in the semis. And the fourth team was Syracuse. That's a pretty good field. And they were playing the old San Diego Sports Arena, which sat about 18,000. And on semifinal Saturday, I walked up to the ticket booth and I bought a ticket at face value. You couldn't do that today. Okay. And and it wasn't the best seat in the house, but it wasn't the worst seat in the house. And so this guy's name was Dick Edwards, the coach. I said, no, I really hadn't thought about that. He said, well, look, if you want to coach in college, I want you as my graduate assistant. That was kind of like, wow, out of the blue. Well, I took the job at Cal Berkeley, and I took a huge pay cut from high school coaching to try to get my foot in the door as a college coach. And one thing led to another. It worked out for me because I coached in college for 25 years.
No, that's what were you studying then at Cal Berkeley at that time as a grad assistant? What were you able to kind of get your foot in with over there?
I didn't have to take anything. Okay.
Oh, that's nice. I just have you on staff.
Have me on staff. Yes. My degree was in political science with a minor in history and English, which really, as you know, prepared me to coach. and I spent, you know, that year at Cal as the grad assistant. They had a junior varsity team that would play the other junior varsities that existed at that time with the other teams. And we played the local junior college as well. And that was part of my job. One of the interesting games, we played an exhibition with the Cons in San Quentin. And so I took my team to San Quentin to play. And that's that was an interesting experience, walking into San Quentin and signing a waiver that says you inside these walls, you understand there's no such thing as a hostage. So if somebody grabs you, they're not going to let the guy out just for you to get out. But it was a good year. And from there, I was hired as a Division II assistant coach in Southern California. And I was there for a year. Mm-hmm. And then I got a break and I was hired by Jim Haney, who's just now retiring as the president of the National Association of Basketball, executive director, excuse me, of the National Association of Basketball Coaches. He was then the head coach at Oregon, had just gotten the job and hired myself and a young guy named Jim O'Brien, who was coming from the East Coast. And that Jim O'Brien later ended up being the head coach of the Celtics and the Sixers and the Pacers. And we've remained very good friends and I've worked with him on a number of occasions. And he was actually hired me for my first job in the NBA, my first full-time job in the NBA. Yeah, so that started a long journey. And like most of us in the college coaching profession, I made several moves. I never made a move for money. I made a move for increased responsibility because I wanted to grow and prepare myself to become a head coach.
Right.
And I always felt that I would have to go back to the Division III or II level and – my dream was to be a D1 head coach, but I'd have to go back to the Division III or II level because I hadn't even played college basketball. And so I went from Oregon to Colorado State for 2 years, then to San Jose State. And I was hired after 5 years there as the head coach at Cal Poly Pomona, which is a Division II team, Division II school in Southern California. The program had been horrible. They'd been last in their league 6 years in a row. At that time, they were the Clippers of college basketball. The Clippers are a lot different now than they were 30 years ago. And so that's where I was first a head coach.
So let's speak a little bit to those. You talked about how you wanted, you know, you're making moves for increased responsibility. So what did when you first got in the foot in the door, so to speak, as a graduate assistant all the way back at Cal Berkeley, you know, and as you moved on to Pomona and Oregon, how did your responsibilities change? How did you have increased responsibilities? Talk a little bit to that.
Sure. Some of the things I would want would be more teaching responsibilities on the court. In terms of maybe running the defense, whatever it might be. When I went to San Jose State, one of my stipulations was I would take over the scheduling. Now, of course, the head coach had final say. There's no question about that. But doing the legwork on scheduling, because I knew that if I was going to become a head coach someplace, I was going to have to work on scheduling. So I'd want to do no more about that. Later on in my coaching career, when I was 90 miles from you at the University of Wisconsin, and Stan Van Gundy, now here I am 5'10", and he says, I want you to handle the bigs. Well, that was great because now I'm in a situation where I was working with Rashard Griffith in the post and trying to help him develop his game and not just working with guards. So I think you're always looking to try to improve yourself And Howard Moore. I'll tell you what, you know, it's obviously a tragic story what's happened with Howard.
Right.
I tried to, when I was the head coach of St. Mary's in California, I twice tried to hire Howard at St. Mary's, and I couldn't get him to come from the Midwest. He had a girlfriend at the time, and we didn't have a lot of money at St. Mary's. St. Mary's got a lot more money now because they hired a guy named Randy Bennett after they fired my butt, and Randy's done a better job than I did. So they've got a little more money to deal with. But, yeah, Howard's just a wonderful man. It's just a it's a tragic situation.
Yeah, yeah, he is. Yeah, no, but I you know, I met him on – I mean, we can segue into this later when we talk more about Wisconsin, but I've met Howard on a number of occasions. He's a phenomenal person. I mean, he the time he takes to connect with kids and, you know, just lay it down the way it is and just be genuine. I think that sticks out above anything else. He's such a genuine person and cares about the kids that he coaches.
He was a wonderful man to work with as a coach, but then to get him know him better after he was a player. And what I would say about Howard, I'm a better person because of my friendship with Howard.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I can definitely see that. All right. So as we were saying, so you were kind of working your way through taking on other responsibilities. San Jose State, you were taking over scheduling. Then you moved. And so what were those other responsibilities that you started to take on previously at like Colorado State and Oregon as you moved up beforehand?
So maybe a role in organizing recruiting, for example, not just being an assistant, but being the person that organized it and headed it up. Some responsibilities dealing with the public in terms of speaking for the basketball program, things of that nature that would just grow. And I tried to, again, in terms of scouting responsibilities, in terms of game preparation responsibilities, just because I was trying to grow as a teacher and as a coach, but also preparing myself with a long-term goal, becoming a head coach.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And then who did you have anyone that mentored you ahead of time, said, hey, this is the path you should take? Or is this a vision that you had already? Like, hey, this is how I think I have to do it.
That's funny you asked that because I was talking to one of those guys today. And that was Bill Van Gundy, the father of Stan and Jeff. And so people would say, well, you worked with Stan. You were Stan's assistant in Wisconsin after he took over from Stu Jackson. Yes, I was. But I'd played in high school against his father's teams. And Stan played in high school against teams I coached. And actually, when I was offered the opportunity to go to Cal Berkeley, I spent two evenings having dinner in the Van Gundy household. Stan was a senior in high school then, discussing with his father, who at that time was a Division II assistant coach, whether I should try to make this move to be a college coach or whether I should stay coaching in high school. And so one of those mentors was ironically Bill Van Gundy, whose son I ended up working for later on. Bill and his wife Cindy live in outside of Orlando, Florida now. And I happened to call him today just to double check to see how he and his wife are doing in light of what's going on in our country with the virus. So, Bill, I would say if I was going to pick one person that was a mentor in terms of encouraged me to move towards college coaching, it would be Bill Van Gundy.
Right. So what did he say to you specifically, you know, some of the key points he said to you in order to not just develop your career, but also made you decide like, hey, this is what I want to do.
I would think more than anything else, and we're going back a long ways now. We're going back to 1976. So you're asking me to think back, 44 years. I think more than anything, the opportunity to challenge yourself to coaching at a higher level, and yes, recruiting is part of it, but the level of attention to detail that in terms of the coaching, it goes up at every level you go up. I mean, in the NBA, the attention to detail is far greater than in college, and it's great in college, but the NBA takes it. Hey, let's face it, in college they got to go to class. In the NBA, they don't have to go to class; they just got to learn the defensive scheme.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's obviously huge differences. I mean, that's, you know, that's a whole other rabbit hole that we can go down, and depending on how this conversation goes, we might be going down it. I always like to bring into awareness to, you know, some coaches that are looking to get their foot into the door, trying to get better? What does that career path look like? You know, and obviously within any profession, I think it's super important to have a mentor that is going to guide you along the way and kind of help give you that vision. Cause you know, if you haven't done it before, it's always nice to be around those people that have done it in those ways.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah. All right. So you got on to Cal Poly Pomona and you switched around or you changed it around. And in 91, I believe you were head coach of the year, right? You were elected coach of the year.
Yeah. In California. Yep. We took over a bad program. It took us a while, but in the fourth year, we were very good. We lost in the conference championship game to Cal State Bakersfield, who went on to win the national championship. So we were good. Okay. I had, you know who Evan Mobley is, correct?
Catino Mobley?
No, Evan Mobley, high school player of the year.
Gotcha. Oh, yes.
Okay, and he has...
I'm thinking further back.
I understand. So Evan Mobley will be a freshman at USC next year, was the high school, this year's National High School Player of the Year. And he has an older brother, Isaiah, who plays at USC now. Well, their father, Eric, was on that last team of mine at Cal Poly Pomona. He was one forward. And you know Terrence Ross that plays for the Orlando Magic now?
Yep.
Our best player was Terry Ross, his father. So I had Terry Ross at one forward and Eric Mobley at the other forward. What I really needed, I needed to have their sons. Both dads were really good, but their sons are all going to be the front line in an NBA one of these days. So we had a good team, and then we had a good team that we were solid the next year as well. But I was going through a divorce, and my... Yep. Ex-wife, who's a wonderful woman, and she was moving to Philadelphia, and my kids were going there. And Jim O'Brien, remember I mentioned earlier I'd worked with him at Oregon. Yep. At this time, he was the head coach of the University of Dayton, and he had been trying to get me to come there as his assistant for a couple of years. And I felt that we were going to have a hard time within our conference, which was the California Collegiate Athletic Association, which at that time was all the Division II schools in Southern California. It's now been merged into a large statewide conference. We're going to have a hard time ever getting better than Cal State Bakersfield because they had more funding and some other things. And so I decided to leave the Division II level and return to the Division I level at the University of Dayton. And as you know, Dayton has a rich basketball history.
Right.
And so I went there to work for Jim O'Brien, who's just a wonderful coach. And I mentioned this about Howard Moore earlier, but I tell people I'm a better coach because of working with Obi, Jim O'Brien, Obi. But more importantly, I'm a better person because he has that kind of influence on you. So I worked there for 2 years. And that was my 18th and 19th years coaching in college. And I'd never been a place where we got fired. But my second year at Dayton, Jim was fired, and therefore so was I. When I went to Dayton, I took the job, and I didn't realize quite how bad his players were, and we couldn't get it turned around fast enough. And so that's when Stu Jackson hired me at Wisconsin as the assistant. But then 3 months after he hired me, Stu left to take the job as the vice president of the fledgling Vancouver Grizzly in the NBA. Stan Van Gundy was elevated. I stayed with Stan, and they gave Stan his walking papers the end of that year. Our two best players on that team were Michael Finley, who went on to an illustrious career in the NBA, and Rashard Griffith. So then I was actually out of college coaching for a year. I decided to return to the San Francisco Bay Area because my ex-wife had moved back there with her kids. And I was going to be near them. And I went to St. Mary's as an assistant for 1 year. And the head coach was a guy named Ernie Kent, who later was the head coach and had great success at Oregon. But everybody felt that Ernie was going to be fired at St. Mary's. But I took the assistant job there. And he wasn't fired. Rather, we won the conference and went on to the NCAA tournament. We played Wake Forest. Wake Forest had this guy named Duncan. You might have heard of him. He was pretty good.
He was all right. Yeah.
And they beat us in a close game in the first round. And then Ernie got the head job at Oregon. And the athletic director at St. Mary's thought that the reason the team had gone from being bad to good was me. So he named me head coach. Now, I was not the reason the team had gone from bad to good. The reason the team went from bad to good was because we had a 7-3 monster in the middle who developed and started to dominate the game. And I remember that Randy Fund, who at that time was the assistant general manager for the Miami Heat, came up to me after the game, after we'd lost to Wake Forest. He says, "Dave, you tell that big guy that today his life changed forever." He was only a sophomore, and he'd been the MVP of the conference tournament. So, hey, I become the head coach. I got this 7-3 guy that's going to be a first-round pick. But unfortunately, he broke his foot the next 3 years.
Oh, jeez.
So over three seasons, I had him for parts of 12 games. And so, you know, in athletics, there's a lot of luck involved, a lot of luck. I mean, look at our team with the Bulls. Had Derrick Rose not blown his knee 3 years in a row, we were pretty darn good with a nice window. And we had a chance to get to the NBA Finals. But, you know, that happens, and that's just life. And so I got fired at St. Mary's after 4 years, and I decided to leave college coaching for a couple reasons and remain in the San Francisco Bay Area. I started a business that works on teamwork development for companies and for educational institutions, taking the acumen I had developed, putting teams together as a college basketball coach and transferring it to the corporate sector. I did some part-time work for a couple NBA teams. And then 3 years later, Jim O'Brien is an advanced scout, meaning doing the X and O preparation. And 3 years later, Jim O'Brien reached out to me and said, "I just got the job for head coach of the 76ers. I need you to be my advanced scout." And that's when I went to work in the NBA.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, that's quite the path to be able to work that way from high school all the way through. I mean, did you ever at the beginning think like, "Hey, I'm going to be in the NBA someday," whether, you know, in some capacity? Was that ever like an inkling in your head, so to speak? Or is it just, "Hey, I want to coach at the Division I level"? And once you got to that, you're just going to see what came. What was the thought process
there? When I started coaching in high school, I wanted to be a head high school coach, and I never had any thoughts of whatsoever of coaching in college, much less in the NBA. Right. Now, I don't coach in the NBA, but of working in the NBA, and I've been now for 16 years in the NBA. I will be out on the road sometimes, and after a game, I might be back at the hotel bar having an adult beverage with a couple other scouts. And sometimes some of them are guys that have had extensive careers in NBA as a player. And I remember saying this one guy one time, "You know, I got to tell you something. I'm a little bit of now here I am. I'm 70 years old, and I'm telling this guy that's probably 40. I'm a little bit in awe of you that I'm sitting here next." And it's I have to pinch myself once in a while. I have made a living in basketball for 45 years. Mind boggling. I never, not in my wildest dreams, I ever think that would happen.
But I mean, that also goes to when you have a passion for something and you work hard, you know, over time you make your own luck. Would you agree?
I would. You know, first of all, you know, you work hard, get lucky. Sometimes you work hard and you may not get lucky. I was just very fortunate. There were a lot of guys that work hard or that are every bit as smart and probably smarter than I am, but they just didn't fall into the right place, the right time. Something worked out for them. I'm very fortunate. I'm very fortunate.
Yeah. Right. All right. So we'll segue more into Bulls here in a second, but let's go back a little bit to those coaching responsibilities as you worked your way through Dayton, Madison, and then out to St. Mary. So we look at recruiting, you know, how was that back then? Cause nowadays, you know, you have social media, you have Twitter, you have these scouting services, et cetera. What was the recruiting trail like back then? And what was going to be the determinant of whether or not you were going to be successful in bringing in the players that you wanted to bring in?
Well, I think the first thing is that when I first started coaching in college, the most important person that you dealt with outside of the player and his immediate family was the high school coach for the most part. The summer travel teams, the AAU stuff, it was just starting. It was more prevalent on the East Coast, and the West really didn't have much footing at all. So I really enjoyed developing the relationships with other coaches. Now, I'm not trying to cast aspersions that they're your AAU coaches. There's some that are really good coaches who have a great interest in the development of the young man or young woman, both on and off the floor. Okay.
Right.
But more high school coaches are that way than AAU coaches, because most high school coaches were trained as educators. They started out being teachers.
Right.
And I enjoyed that. And that's one of the things, one of the places things have really changed. The middlemen involved, what I'm going to call the underbelly of college basketball, has grown, and that's unfortunate. Now, if you were to ask me, were there unethical things done when I started coaching in college in 76? Oh, of course there were. Of course there were. When I was the assistant in Oregon, Oregon won the first NCAA championship in 1939. A gentleman named Howard Hobson was the coach. He left Oregon. This doesn't make sense today, but he left Oregon to take the job as the head coach at Yale. And he retired, and he was living back in Eugene, Oregon. He came by our offices one day and stuck his head in my office. Mm-hmm. And he told me a story about how he recruited the best player on that first NCAA championship team. His name was Slim Wintermute. You can look it up. The team was called the Tall Furs. Slim was a wing player. He wasn't one of the Tall Furs, but he was their best player. And he had recruited him in 1935 in the middle of the Depression. And he told me a story, and the story he told me certainly wouldn't pass the NCAA litmus test about how he ended up at Oregon. So people doing things that are a little bit unethical has been going on forever, and it's not going to change.
Right.
But unfortunately, it may have grown a little bit. So there's some things of that nature that's kind of why really right now I'm glad that I'm not coaching in college right now. I think the challenges are greater.
Right.
The rules that are going in that allow players to transfer willy-nilly from one institution to another.
Right.
Yes, right. I think that there previously were rules that restricted players' movement too much, and now the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction. You can't coach a player today. If you criticize the fan says, I'm transferring, and they can. And the NCAA next month is going to vote on a rule that would allow them one-time transfer, no rules or whatever. You're just immediately eligible where we transfer to. That's going to be very difficult.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be like I've talked with a number of coaches. They just said it's going to be like the wild, wild west out there. It's going to be you have that one perspective where, some kids are going to be doing that. And then the other perspective is, some kids are going to be thinking the grass is green on the other side. And they're going to realize really quickly that maybe they should have stayed in that original place with the group that wanted you. Sometimes your ability to persevere and get through those tough times. I mean, that's what builds character, and that's what allows you to kind of get through those more difficult situations, later down in life.
Isn't it ironic that the guard Witt at Arkansas this year started at Arkansas, went to SMU, and finished his career back at Arkansas? The same thing's true with the kid Jake Toulson at BYU. Started at BYU, transferred to Utah Valley, finished his career back at Utah. Maybe they recognized the grass wasn't necessarily greener.
Right, right. And I mean, at that stage, you get that first transfer where it's no skin off of either group's nose, but then all of a sudden you got to wait another year if you want to go back or if you want to go somewhere else. And that's where, I mean, at what stage can kids just all of a sudden, they're going to be 23, 24? They have a playing limit, how long they can stay in college, but it just seems like it could get a little too out of hand and coaches and players. It just sounds like it's going to be a mess here for a couple of years, if not forever.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And you know what? This ties in a little bit what we're going to talk about later on. The role of parents in this whole thing in raising young men or young women who understand the concept that loyalty is not just a one-way street. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that if a college head coach leaves to take a job at another school, the kids that he recruited to that program should be able to leave and go also. Not to the school he went to, because that causes problems with infighting between institutions, which I don't think is a good way to go. But I think the players, they should be able to move in that situation, because part of the reason they went to that school was because who the coach was. At the same time,
it's a huge influence. Huge influence. That's why people,
As parents, I think it's incumbent upon us, and I'm a parent. My children are grown now, but I mean, to help them understand their levels of, hey, if you make a commitment someplace, you got to live up to that commitment. And sometimes I think parents have abdicated their roles as disciplinarian, as role model, whatever it might be. I'm not saying all parents, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that there are certainly parents who they need to step in and, hey, no, this is what you do. You made a commitment to this team. You're not going to quit in the middle of the season or transfer in the middle of the season. So,
yeah, be a man of your word, so to speak. Like this, this is it. Right. All right. So, yeah, we'll definitely get into the parents a little bit more. But let's talk a little bit to that coaching career a little bit more from the perspective of, you know, what were some traits that you saw between, you know, championship culture type teams and teams that didn't have very winning seasons? I mean, what were, you know, broad overview pieces that you could speak to?
Well, let's eliminate the single biggest factor in how good any team is the innate athleticism and skill set of the players. Okay. So let's assume that all teams are equal. Okay. In terms of the skill set and athleticism.
Yep.
The next most important thing on whether a team is successful or not is not how much the coach knows. The next most important thing is what level of ownership for the team's success is taken by those players and what kind of internal leadership is developed. As a coach, I think it's incumbent upon us to cultivate those skills. One, because I think we need to help the young man or woman grow in those areas. But two, because from a selfish standpoint, that's going to have a lot more to do with whether or not your team is successful than your out of bounds plays or your press offense, any of those things.
I was just going to follow up into that as, you know, how is that internal leadership developed? Like how do you go about developing those qualities?
Well, some of it is inherent in the players you recruit. That's something you need to keep as a on the top of your head, okay? With the Bulls, one of the reasons we drafted Coby White last year, Coby White, now think about this, not a lot of players are this way. If you watch Coby White play basketball at Carolina, Coby White is happy for his teammates' successes. Mm-hmm. Some players aren't. Mm-hmm. They think it's all about me. Mm-hmm. So one, in recruiting players that sort of fit that, and then in cultivating leadership, I think we have a responsibility to try to develop those skills in our players. So in practice, as often as possible, I put the players in decision-making roles. I know that in the final analysis, at the end of a game, we got to decide what we're going to do in the last second play. I'm going to make the final decision. But I want to put those guys in positions to empower them as often as possible in practice to develop those skills. So we were playing, when I was head coach at St. Mary's, we were playing UC Santa Barbara. And it was late. It's one of those games where everything was going well. And then in the last 6 minutes, everything we touched turned to caca. We couldn't do anything right. Okay. And the next thing you know, they come from 15 behind to score with like 12 or 14 seconds and go up by one. Well, like any smart coach, I call timeout. And I know what I want to do. And I had a very good foreman and a very good point guard.
Yep.
And the point guard was a good little leader. And he comes running over to the huddle and grabs me and says, "Coach, put Eric at the top of the key. Tell everybody else to get the hell out of the way. We'll win this game." Now, I'm going to tell you, it wasn't exactly what I was going to do, but it was close enough. It was close enough, and my two best players wanted to do it, so we did it.
Right.
We won the game. The fans all thought I was really smart. Here's where I was smart. I was smart enough to listen to my players. Now, I also had built a culture in which the players felt comfortable saying that to me. If you the college basketball has two 20-minute halves and a 15-minute halftime. We go in at halftime. The first 5 minutes, I'm going to talk to my assistant coaches. The last 5 minutes, we're going to come out and warm up. We're going to be ready to go. I remember hearing Al McGuire say this years ago at a clinic, a lot of games are won in the first 2 minutes of the second half because one team spent too much time in the locker room. They weren't really fully warmed up. We're going to come out and warm up. Now, what do I do in that middle 5 minutes? I'm going to talk with our team. And the very first thing I do every time is, and literally I would be kneeling down on the floor looking at them eyeball because they're sitting in the chairs, and I'd be saying, what do you see out there? What do you think is happening? Now, if they're saying it, Eric, then they're taking ownership for it. And 95% of what I'm going to say, they'll say. They already see it. They're smart guys. But if they're saying it, they're more likely to take ownership for it. And then I'd make a few other tweets, you know, a tweak here and a tweak there, an adjustment here, an adjustment there, and we go out to play. But by as often as possible, solicit their input. Now, we all know that in teaching, we have time constraints. So sometimes you can't do that. But where possible, try to empower your players and give them an opportunity to grow.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to so many things from a development standpoint, because I always like to say, you know, if you teach them once, you know, they have to be able to, obviously you have to be able to reinforce certain things and certain behaviors, but you need to be able to teach them in those short sound bites, see what they get, and then have them reinforce those things. And so that's not always you huddling up, hey, what do we have to do here? What do you do there? But tell them to huddle up and then hear what they're talking about. Let's hear what players are saying of what adjustments they have to make. And then if they make the adjustments when they go back out, great. If not, then you can come back in and you can talk a little bit more. But being able to have those conversations within practice, which then lead to those conversations in games, you know, and it was a part of my development as a player. And before I went and played overseas as well, as you know, once I got overseas and played professionally, that was a great opportunity for me to see something different, because I always felt it was lecture. And then all of a sudden you're put in this situation. It's like, hey, figure this out. What are you seeing? Talk with your teammates. What is your strategy? Why are you choosing the strategy? So on and so forth. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say two thoughts on that, Eric. Number one, I learned from a guy named George Terzian, who was a great high school coach at Pasadena High School. When I was a young assistant and I'd be at his practices, and he made a great point to me. It's not our job to show the players all the basketball we know.
Right.
And then another, I went brain dead. And the other thing I was going to say about that, dealing with helping them develop. Oh, it'll come back to me.
For sure. So what I was saying was, you know, and once we got over there, we'd have situations where, you know, whether during practice, okay, whether, you know, whatever set you're going to run on offense or whatever you're going to run on defense, like you make that plan. And then when it's not going well, you call your own timeouts and figure out what's going on and make those changes. And I don't think that can start early enough.
Agreed.
Because I see as I get into more middle schools and high schools and AU programs, there's either two things happening. Either the coach isn't talking at all and the players aren't talking, or the coach is saying everything. And, you know, you can see the kids going brain dead because they're not cognitively involved. They're just listening more and more and more and more. They're like, all right, when is this guy going to be quiet? So to force them, like, hey, you have to talk. You have to, I mean, it's not 100% guarantee, but I think that's a key point to be able to develop some of those leadership characteristics that you're looking for in the culture that you want.
Well, I think one of the things that happens, Eric, in this day and age, a lot of youngsters, regardless of sport, we're talking, you and I are dealing more in basketball, but this could be any sport.
Right.
They're not playing the sport unless they have an adult that's running the show. They're not going down to the playground and choosing up teams and playing touch football, right, or choosing up teams and playing baseball with just five on a side and cutting the diamond in half, or choosing up teams and playing 3-on-3 basketball, where you are put in that position to be the leader without an adult there. And I think that's one of the changes in how young men and women grow up today. Parents always think they have to be there, some parent or some adult, to be the leader. Well, you don't need to. Let the kids choose their own teams. I would do this as a college head coach. First of all, oftentimes I'd have in competitive drills, I'd have two guys choose the teams. Well, first of all, one of the things that helps is that I can find out who they think, hey, when it's up to winning, now I know who the player really wants to play with. But I can also go to the last guy that's chosen and says, you're pissed off to me because you're not getting enough minutes, but you're always the last guy chosen. You know, when it's going to be a penalty for losing, you know, your teammates feel the same way I do. You don't rebound enough. But I would always take, and I would say, all right, you five in blue, you five in red. Blues are ahead by three. There's a minute and 10 seconds to go in the game. You guys figure out what you're going to do. Play it out, and then we will debrief. But I had to learn to keep my mouth shut. Keep my mouth. Let them make mistakes, and then we'll talk about it.
Right. Right. No, 100% agreed. And because a lot of times as a coach, you almost learn more than the players do, because you're like, oh, well, they saw some things that I maybe didn't necessarily see, you know, that whether it be a person in a certain position or, you know, how they wanted to get into a certain shot. You know, there's some of those kids out there be like, oh, well, you know, certain kids or a group of kids, their IQs kind of pop out a little bit. You're like, okay, you know, and then you can give them a little bit more freedom there too. And it kind of creates a little bit more trust, so to speak.
Well, also when it comes to being a coach or any other thing we do in life, there's a reason the good Lord gave us two ears and just one mouth. And we have a tendency to use our mouth too much. I tell people all the time, I'm just smart enough to know I'm stupid. I just want to keep learning. You know, we all have friends. You got 100 questions. I got 101 answers. I'm still working on the questions. I'm trying to figure the questions out. I think listening is a skill that you've got to cultivate. And that includes as a coach, even though you're in the position of leadership, well, you're going to make the final decision, but you need to listen to people leading up to that decision.
For sure. 100%. If you can't listen, I mean, a lot of times people aren't even going to bother hearing what you have to say. I mean, you have to listen. You have to be not more than equal, but yeah, you have to be able to have that skill of comprehending, understanding, analyzing what other people are saying, and then having smart responses to that as well. Not just letting it go in one ear and out the other. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk a little bit to the culture of the programs. What did you notice in some of those players, such as, like I said, like you talked about before, Rashard Griffith or Michael Finley, some of those players that went on to play at some elite levels? What stood out for them as players in comparison to their competitors?
Well, again, let's assume that they're blessed with the same, relatively the same level of athleticism, okay? So the two players are starting the same spot, all right? If the two players are starting the same spot, number one, who's most willing to work on their game? Who's most willing to be coachable and listen? And then, for example, Michael Finley was a tireless worker. You know, when Michael Finley played at Proviso East, he was the third best player in that high school team. Now, in fairness, the other two guys, Sherelle Ford and Donnie Boyce, both had a cup of coffee in the NBA, but Mike had a 15-year career. So why was that? Well, I don't know enough about Donnie Boyce and Sherelle Ford to know if they had already started a plateau, had they reached their physical peak in 12th grade. Right. But I do know that Michael was a tireless worker, and that's part of the way he elevated his game. So it's hard, you know, one is to open up your mind and let yourself be coached. Two is to be willing to put the work in, not just on your basketball skill set, but also on your body. Okay, it's amazing. Some guys come into the NBA and it's like, you've never lifted a weight? Are you kidding me? And didn't you realize that guys are bigger and stronger in the NBA? Right. To learn to do the off-court things, to eat properly, to get the right amount of rest, to hydrate your body, to lift correctly, to stay keep your fitness level high, and to work on your skill set.
Right.
It's a job. It's a profession.
Right.
When you get to our level, I remember early on when I was with the Bulls, I'd be back in Chicago in Deerfield where our offices were then and getting ready for the draft, and Luol Deng would be down the court working. And he'd come in the morning, and he'd work with an assistant coach on his skill set, whatever it might be, for a couple hours. He'd go home. He'd come back in the afternoon. He'd lift for 90 minutes. He'd go home. He'd come back at night, and two of his buddies would shag balls, and he'd shoot for 2 hours. That's in June when we got knocked out of the playoffs in May. He took, you know, a few weeks off, and then he's back. That's if you want to be good, that's what you have to do. And so I think the difference between, again, this is assuming that Look, I could have worked my ever-loving rear off, and I was never going to be Michael Jordan. He was, right. You know, 7 inches taller and a whole lot more athletic. But assuming you start with the same physical dimensions and similar athleticism, it's going to be who is willing to be coached and who is willing to work on their game.
Right. Well, let's also speak to, you know, you get some of those players, like, let's take, for example, Steve Nash, who had a very phenomenal career in the NBA, who wasn't necessarily gifted with that typical athleticism of being able to drive on people or dunk or be bigger than people. But he had incredible vision. He had incredible IQ and court sense. And he had those couple of things that he was really good at. I mean, he could hit the three. I mean, he could have a low pull-up. He had his little floaters. And he mastered what he needed to do in order to be successful for his position. So, you know, what do players have to do in order to figure out, hey, this is, you know, this is what I have to be able to do to be successful?
Well, I think it's different in the college and the NBA level. Most college players are, you know, you're as a college coach, you're probably recruiting the best player on his high school team or his AAU team, and they're probably pretty well-rounded in terms of they do a lot of things well. At the next level, there may be 15 to 20 franchise-type players in the NBA. The rest, you know, that do multiple things well. The Greek Freak, yep. LeBron, Steph Curry, right. KD, we can go on and on, okay? But they're only about 15 to 20 of right. those. The rest of the group, they have one thing that's going to get them into a game. And that one skill is going to get them onto a court and right. into an NBA game. Now, if that gets them into the NBA game, then they may have a chance to hone their other skills. But I'm
like Jimmy Butler, for example.
Jimmy Butler started out as a defensive player. Mm-hmm. Great work habits, great worker. Okay, and that's part of the reason he got on the court because he could guard. And then because he had time on the court, his offensive game blossomed. But if he hadn't been that defender to start with, he never would have got on the floor. Okay? So on the Bucks team, Robin Lopez, he can rim protect and rebound. You don't want Robin Lopez shooting the three, right? Now, Brooke can shoot the three, but not Robin. But Robin has a skill that's going to get him into an NBA game. Now, he's a veteran player. But take him back right. 10 years ago when he was a rookie, that was going to – and I always liked Robin when he was at Stanford. I thought Robin was going to have a better career than some people thought he would, and he did, in fact, has had that career because he was always a worker. He was always a worker. Mm-hmm. And he would rebound, and he'd bring some toughness. Okay, so another player might be somebody that just really handles the ball well and knows how to get the ball to your best players. So I think looking to find a player with one specific skill that really translates to the game and that the head coach can make use of at the NBA level, that's important. At the college level, the player needs to be more well-rounded.
Right. So how do you, as you're scouting, collegiate players, and do you just scout colleges right now, or do you look at high school players? Do you look internationally?
I mean,
your role, so to speak?
So with us, I handle Latin America also, and I've started to do some things in Africa last year. But primarily, 95% of my time is on college. Now, I say college, but that may start. We met each other at the U16s in Fort Lauderdale last year. Okay, so until 2 years ago, well, not 2 years ago, this was the first year, last year, the spring of 2019, was the first time that we as NBA scouts were allowed to go to the U16 trials. I will start seeing young players beginning then, okay?
Okay.
But I won't necessarily see them. I can't go to a high school game to see them. We're restricted to certain things we
can go to.
But now... So my focus is potential players coming out of college, but I may have started seeing them when they were young at things like the old Adidas Nations event or the Nike Academy, which used to be the LeBron camp, or in USA basketball events. Mm-hmm. And so I'll start tracking them at a very young age.
And what are you tracking?
Their physical development, their emotional development, and their skill set development. All of those.
Yeah, just everything. Yeah, exactly. Seeing where, and then as they're starting to come of age, so to speak, as they get into those early parts of
the collegiate career. You know, you, like you said, you go from this well-rounded player, and as you get into college, you're still well-rounded, but you get a little bit more specific. You know, at what, you know, are you able to have conversations with certain people then, as far as like, hey, if he wants to do anything, he needs to be at, like, you know, like this, he's got to focus on this, or is that something that just comes from, okay.
I had a college coach call me the other day, asking me about a young 6'9" freshman. And he said, and I've known this coach for a long time. He's the assistant on the team, was a former Division I head coach. And I said to Keith, look, let's go through. Here are the things that I like about him, and here's the things where he needs to improve. For him to be a player for us to consider at the NBA level, he's got to get better in X, Y, and Z. And so, yes, I will have those conversations, Now, I cannot have those conversations with a player. That's against the rules.
Right.
But I will have that conversation with coaches, Now, if they ask, I'm not I'm not intrusive in this respect, in that it's their program to run. But in this case, the coach called me and wanted some suggestions.
Gotcha. All right. So
I would not call Sean Miller at Arizona and say, Sean, you should do this, this and this. That's just not, no, it doesn't work.
Right. Gotcha.
And while Sean would take the call, because I know him well, Coach K wouldn't even take the call.
Gotcha. So if coaches wanted to reach out to you and had questions, then you know, then you can give them some insights to help better, you know.
Well, I don't know if I have much insights. I have my opinion. It's sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong.
Gotcha. When you're looking at players at the collegiate level, at what stage do you start getting interested? Like, all right, I think this kid's really got potential. We got to really put him on our radar and really start looking, you know, at more game film. Because I'm sure you have all these players that you're looking at, and then it's, you know, you get through that filtering process, and then all of a sudden, like, all right, you start to get through these couple players for whatever the organization is needs at that time. At what stage do you have like a timetable as far as when kids have to start, you know, when you start looking at kids a little bit deeper, or like what is that process like?
I would say that, let's say we're in training camp in the fall and we have some series of meetings getting organized for the scouting for the draft. And we may have, let's say, 400 players on our radar. Now, there may be 20 to 30 that we think these are the top ones, and maybe another 20 to 30, which are the secondary group, and other players are going to move from group to group as they develop physically and as develop their skill set.
Yep.
And as we watch them. So I would say you're always being evaluated. I tell players this all the time. Every time you cross that black line and step on the court, somebody's watching you, and you better bring your A game, because you never know who might be watching you. I remember having a conversation with Will Barton one time, who plays for Denver, and Will was I was fortunate enough for about 5 or 6 years in a row, Nike brought me back to Chris Paul's elite guard camp, where he has like 15 to 18 college players and probably 35 high school guards, and they brought me back to work out the college guys, and I worked with Will, and so one night, he had done a great job, and I was complimenting him on the job he did. And the next day on the bus, I was complimenting. I said, thanks, coach. And I said to him, then how come when I was in Memphis, because Will played at Memphis, when I was at practice last year, you were late to practice in the morning? He looked at me. I said, yeah, I'll tell you the day it was. You practiced twice that day, and you just thought I was some old gray-haired alum sitting in the stands. Because that night, there were 5 other NBA scouts there with me, and you looked over us every time you did something good. And he laughed, and I said, what you don't understand, Will, is somebody is watching you all the time. You never know who it is.
Right.
If I'm working with high school kids at Don Showalter Snow Valley Basketball School, and I'll tell them, you know what? You may hope to be a Division II player, and I'm just some old guy that doesn't coach in college anymore, but I might have a guy call me and say, hey, Dave, did you see Sammy Smith at Don's camp? Yeah, I had him. Tell me about him. You never know when somebody's watching you. And it's true for all walks of life. But right now we're talking about basketball. So if I'm evaluating a player for our level, number one, they have to have a requisite level of athleticism. That doesn't mean they have to be the best athlete, but you can't be, you know, you can't be me, all right, with no quickness.
Right.
You have to have a requisite level of athleticism. Number two, mm-hmm. you got to have a specific skill that's going to get you into a game. And number three, now I'm watching your intangibles. Are you team oriented? What are your work habits? And I'm asking people these questions all the time. As an NBA scout, I go to a college game. I go to see Marquette play at home. I show up 90 minutes before the game. And I'm in the building. I'm watching this guy warm up. I'm watching him. I'm studying his shot. I want to learn all I can, especially if it's a big who may only get one jump shot in the whole game. But in warmups, I can see him shoot 50. So I'm watching to see if his stroke is broke or if it's something that can be fixed. But I'm also talking to people. I would never talk to Steve. Right. He's back in the locker room. But the assistants that are out there on the floor, the strength coach, the SID, the radio guy, what's he like when you do a post-game interview with him? I'm asking these people all the time, trying to build a mosaic going into our database, a mosaic of what he might be like as a player to have on your team. Those things are all very, very important.
Yeah, no, and it kind of really rings true to something Howard Moore had said back in the day as well. We had him before NCAA changed their rules this past year. We had my middle schoolers up the year before to go watch a practice. And then he took some time to just kind of sit down with the guys and you talk to him we weren't expecting it. I mean, we were just going to watch and then leave. And he talked to him for a good 30, 40 minutes about, you know, how they go about recruiting and scouting and things they look for. And, you know, it just, one of the first things he says, like, hey, if we have any interest in to you, you know, if you have the skill level, first thing we'll do is we're going to call that front office and, you know, we're going to talk to the secretary and you're going to ask for, you know, Joe Smith and we're going to hear one, two things. We're either going to hear, oh, Joe Smith. Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. Or it's going to be, oh, Joe. Yeah. Yeah. We can, you know, and it's one of those things like you never at all times, you're constantly being evaluated in all parts of your life and you never know what part is going to create that opportunity or take away an opportunity. And you have to, so you always have to try to live your best self, so to speak.
I will go to the strength coach before a game and I'll say, who's your best worker? He says, you mean amongst the walk-ons or the guys you're interested in? I said, no, just who's the best couple of workers on your team? And if he gives me two or three names and he hasn't mentioned the guy that I'm there to see yet, that's a red flag. I'll walk into the offices of the college basketball offices, and I'll see the admin in the front. I'll ask her, when the players walk through here, who makes you smile the most? And I'm trying to find – now, the fact that – If she doesn't say the guy I'm there to see, well, that may be fine. He just may have a different personality. If I asked her, give me the people. Well, here's my come to Jesus question for people: could he marry your daughter? It gets quiet sometimes. I'll tell you a funny one because I work for the Bulls. I'm at Wendell Carter Jr.'s high school. He went to Pace Academy in Atlanta. I'm talking with the athletic director, whose name escapes me. Very nice gentleman. I'm talking to the athletic director, and I asked him that question. Could he marry your daughter? And he says, well, I'll tell you what. He took her to the senior prom. I said, well, that guy just put his money where his mouth was. They weren't boyfriend, girlfriend. They were just in the same clique of friends, and they need and he took her to the senior ball or whatever it was. You know what? We're looking at investing a lot of money in some young man. We want to find out he's the kind of young man we want. He's going to be team oriented and be a worker. And Wendell was flying colors.
Right. No, that's a great story. And it just kind of goes to, you know, how people are looking at the entire picture, not just like how skilled you are, but are you a good person? Are you a good character? Do you want your teammates to succeed?
I'm not going to tell you the name of the coach or the name of the player, but I had one situation where I asked that of a coach, and it got really quiet at the other end. This was not a face-to-face. I was on the phone. It got really quiet.
Right.
I said, no, you don't have to answer that. No, I want to answer that. Absolutely not. And then he went on to list the reasons why. And I'm thinking to myself, then why were you just telling me what a good guy he is?
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. It catches them whenever you hear that silence. That's a red flag more times than not. That's for sure.
They're not called pregnant pauses for no reason.
Were there any players that you've been pleasantly surprised with over the past, you know, 5-10 years doing scouting for the Bulls, where you're like, oh, well, maybe this is how far he can go, but he was really able to shine, and then kind of expand on if there was a player, you know,
why? Well, we touched on one early, Jimmy Butler.
Jimmy Butler, now, yeah.
Yeah, we identified Jimmy. I got lucky on this one. I think most everybody felt he'd be maybe a late second round pick. And then I'm scouting at the and I would, because I live on the West Coast, I might see Jimmy once a year, whereas other people, yep, even in our organization, might see him multiple times. But I'm at the Big East tournament that year, and as you may or may not remember, Buzz mostly played Jimmy in the high post as an undersized four. But in the Big East tournament, he changed the offense. He put him outside. And subsequently, Buzz and I have discussed this. He says, you're right, I did. And I called John Paxson and Gar Foreman. I said, we need to revisit Jimmy Butler. He can do some things we didn't know he could do. And then and we tracked him through the NCAA tournament that year, and then at Portsmouth and the Portsmouth Invitational. And I remember interviewing him at Portsmouth, and he was our guy. We got him at 30, but we would have taken him at 13. We just saw some stuff that some other people maybe didn't. I got lucky because I was at the Big East tournament when he did get to play outside. And
yep,
to his credit, he's a worker and he developed. So he's one where I was right on. I could tell you some where I was wrong on too, in both directions, where a player that I didn't think was going to be a good enough player would go to a certain school, it's a certain NBA team, and then he blossomed. And ended up being a better player than I thought he would be.
Well, a lot of times that has to do with the fit as well, right? As far as the personality within the culture.
That's certainly a factor. Fit's a factor, but I'll tell you what, work habits and commitment is a bigger factor.
Right. Okay. I had just a few more things in regards to some of the coaching things. If you're looking back at young Dave Bullwinkle, would you tell him to do anything different? Any advice that you would give him?
Yeah, I'd tell him in terms of being a teacher. You remember I said about NBA players coming out of college have one skill that can really get them on the court. I would have focused in a specific area to become known as the expert in that area of teaching. For example, Ron Adams, who's now, you know, with Golden State as an assistant and was with the Bulls at one time, and Ron and I go back to being young college assistants that we knew each other at rival schools on the West Coast.
Yep.
Ron's niche is defense, and he has become known as a worldwide as a great defensive teacher. I think I would have tried to specialize in one specific area.
Okay, gotcha. And any advice that you would give to any aspiring, you know, coaches and scouts, actually, one for each?
Meet as many people as you can. Just like the players always understand that you got to put your best foot forward because you never know who's evaluating you. And put yourself in from the coaching perspective, put yourself in as many positions where you can teach the game as possible. I still love to teach. It's the reason I work for Don Showalter at his camp every summer for a couple of weeks. I can get on the court. I don't have to teach when I was at CP3's Elite Guard Camp, those guys were really good players. I can be working with some elementary school, you know, kids. It makes no difference. You're still teaching basketball. I love to teach basketball. If you have a passion for teaching, then find opportunities to do so.
Got it. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Dave. We've kind of hit our time here, so I appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Eric. It's my privilege. All the best, and to all the young players out there, work hard.